Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Dinner with Nate. It's been a few weeks, but I am back. Took a little break. Today, my guest is Professor Margaret Schwartz. She's a feminist materialist media theorist at Fordham University and a very old friend of mine from back in my days in Chicago. We today are dining on lamb biryani and discussing the 1978 musical comedy Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, starring the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton. You heard that right. Here we go. Listeners, I'm here with Margaret Schwartz, very old friend, and I have coerced her into watching Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, the movie starring the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton and George Burns.
And George Burns.
From 1978. I was four. And we are also going to discuss the recipe that she pitched to me. Can you tell me what it's called?
It's lamb biryani. Okay. From Hyderabad. I think Hyderabad, which means like South Central India, and probably because it's meat of Muslim provenance rather than Hindu, but that's all I really know about it.
Okay.
It's like a wedding. It's a fancy, it's not something you'd make every day.
Totally. I neglected to hit the record button, but I'm going to repeat this. This recipe, me working on it today, may have been the most stressful thing that I've cooked in a long time. And that is not because it is overly difficult. There are a lot of steps involved, but I felt like I was a little bit out of my normal wheelhouse in cooking. So I was kind of learning some stuff, which is kind of the whole point of getting these recipes from people on this podcast. But it smells awesome and we'll try it in a little bit.
I made it to
after
you.
We talk for a bit.
And that's awesome.
Yeah.
No one in my family wants to eat it but me.
I know. I mean, it does involve lamb, listeners. I'm not sure if you would want to do it with anything else because lamb's really good, I think. But no one in my household will eat lamb. But my neighbors are super stoked for me to bring some over to them.
Sweet.
Because they hooked me up with cardamom. Which I couldn't.
Oh, nice.
I couldn't find cardamom pods anywhere.
Really?
And yeah, there's a lot of things that have been really difficult for me to find lately. Well, not lately. Some things are coming back, but then some things are cannellini beans. I've complained about this on multiple podcasts. For some reason, for like 3 months, I couldn't find cannellini beans anywhere. They're back now. But now I can't find cardamom pods. But
I wonder if they were on the Evermore in the Suez. Just stuck there.
Yep. Just cans of cannellini beans stuck in the Suez Canal.
We're trying to buy like lawn chairs. I belong to this like pool co-op club thing. And so we have to donate stuff. We're trying to buy lawn chairs and there's no lawn chairs because they were all on the Evermore.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm wondering if stuff that I've ordered on Wish is still like we're on that or something. That's why I haven't gotten it yet. Or just Wish is always late, I think. Okay, so let's listeners, we're going to talk about this recipe first because I want to eat some of it because it's kind of early dinner time here in Portland. Margaret, you're in New York, so it's a bit later there.
It's late dinner time for me, but I'm hungry. I could do it. I had a late lunch, but I haven't had dinner yet.
Okay. And this is Memorial Day weekend. So, I guess like, you know, that we're recording this. So, you know, a lot of people have tomorrow off, so might as well stay up and eat late.
Stay up and eat some festive saffron laced delightfulness.
Yes. Okay. So you don't make this that often, obviously, because like we just said, your household isn't super into lamb.
not excited about eating baby sheep. Yeah. Though baby sheep are delicious. I make it. I made it New Year's Eve was the first time I made it.
Okay.
And then I made it for Passover because lamb is kind of one of those things that you would often have at Passover. And I decided some people don't eat rice for Passover because it metaphorically rises. Okay. And I decided that I couldn't handle that and I was going to eat rice. So I
haven't heard that one.
Yeah. It's like, I was raised by wolves, so I don't really understand all the things, but my understanding is it's obviously wheat and bread, but it's also like legumes and anything that sort of takes a while to cook and gets bigger. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So, but Sephardic people, like Jews from Northern Africa and the Mediterranean, are actually totally fine with rice at Passover. So I was like, I don't know, maybe I'm Sephardic. I don't know. I just want to eat rice. I can't handle a non-carb Passover. So,
I'd like to say that my wife is, her Jewish family in the US comes from Texas. So they eat everything.
They're like, whatever. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, my family thinks I'm like, I've drunk the Kool-Aid because I even noticed that these holidays happen. Like everyone in my family's like a communist or an atheist or a, but I'm a, I don't know. 3,000 years of beautiful tradition. What are you going to do? You got to do something with it. So I made it for Passover, and weirdly, my in-laws, who are Midwestern goys, loved this recipe. My father-in-law was a huge big fan. So that was like an incentive to keep it on the roster of like holiday foods. But yeah, it is many steps. I find it fascinating that there's like a gravy making process that is totally different than how I would make gravy. Like if I had like roasted something, I would, do it totally differently. The layers, I love that there's like lots of fresh herbs in it. I love that there's like weird ass ingredients. Yeah. Like, and I've been on this Indian cooking spree. So I was like trying to learn as much as I could. And try all kinds of new stuff. So it was super fun. I did it with the dough, to make it a proper dum, which it means I think that means like the actual dish, you know, the sealed. You have to do the dough. And
I did it.
You did it.
Rob, I wasn't gonna. But yeah, I did.
I didn't do it.
I felt like I was running out of time, and I was like, and then I was like, I have to do it because I haven't done this. So listeners, you in the very end part of cooking this dish, you make a dough and seal the pot with dough and then put it in an oven. And the dough like really like even if you have a good tight lid, it's never, I don't think it's, you know, going to be completely sealed. Maybe it is. I don't know. But you, with this particular recipe, you put dough around the rim of the pot and seal it with dough. So it like bakes this dough to like really, really seal all the flavor in, which makes me really stoked about what this is going to taste like.
I cheated and I foiled because I was like, you know what? I just like, I can't, life is too short. I also made it with goat's milk yogurt and goat's milk instead of cream because I have difficulty digesting milk.
That's okay.
So yeah.
I like goat's milk.
I will tell you this. It is far more satisfying than any milk alternative, which just makes me very sad inside.
I mean, I don't do milk in general. It just kind of grosses me out a little bit in general.
I like it in my tea and my coffee.
But I love cheese.
Cheese is amazing. And cheese doesn't like me. So I have to say goodbye to cheese. Oh, that's okay.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us a little bit. Do you have the recipe there?
No, but I can grab it.
Would you grab it and like kind of run us through the way you do it? Because maybe I made things more complicated for myself.
Yeah. All right.
So you've got
it's in the India cookbook written by Pushpesh Pant. My favorite thing about this cookbook is that it has a little star on it that says quality assurance. And it says the only book on Indian food you'll ever need. So I was like, yes, sign me up for this biz.
It's like the silver spoon for Italian food.
Yeah, exactly. It's like and in fact, there is on Netflix right now like documentary about Indian food and regions, and its name is in Hindi, and so I don't know what it is, but Pushpesh Pant is a frequent talking head, so I feel like my quality assurance is definitely playing out, because this guy is obviously the go-to guy to talk to.
What year was this cookbook?
Was the cookbook published? That's a good question. Let me find out.
I'm just curious.
Yeah.
I'm basing this on like how the recipe was written.
Yes, it's in the back. 2010 is when it was first published.
Okay, it's not that old.
Yep.
Okay.
Nope. This is just a person with an unwieldy manner of expressing himself.
Well, I mean, there are newer cookbooks that I run into sometimes where I'm just like, who wrote this? I feel like it wasn't the person that wrote the actual recipe. It was like somebody like dictating for them or something, and just like got something goofy. There's one recipe in one of my Ottolenghi cookbooks, which I can't remember which one, where it tells you to preheat the oven, and you never use the oven for this recipe. And that drove me crazy. I was just like, what is going, like, I'm reading it and I was like, when am I supposed to put it in the oven? And then realizing this is a total goof up in the cookbook.
That's food making insane. Cause I do tend to assume that like, it's just gospel, right? Like I'm very, especially when it's like, not my culture, you know, it's like, I will do exactly what this says.
Yep.
Oh no. Yeah.
Okay,
so the best way to describe what this recipe is that it's a super fancy casserole. It's like it's a baked meat and herbs and rice and gravy situation. And it has a bunch of different parts to it in terms of like the layers, right? So what they tell you to do first is to put saffron into lukewarm milk and make a paste. But you don't actually use that until the end. Interestingly, when I was first making this, I went to my local Indian grocery store and they were like, I mean, I bought the saffron, but everyone actually, evidently in India, or not everyone, but the people in the grocery store led me to believe that nowadays people mostly actually just use orange food coloring to do the saffron does. When you open it, you'll see it gives a wonderful color to it. It's really exciting. And of course, so how I got into Indian food is that I was interested in Ayurveda. And it's just like, it's such a cool, like I have an autoimmune disease. And so I have certain food restrictions and I wanted to find the food that I was eating to be delicious and not sort of, you know, sad and not delicious. Yeah. As one sometimes does. I mean, I don't know. The cool thing about Ayurveda is that it's really supposed to spark the mind and the body and all of the senses. And so color and fragrance are also really important in Ayurveda cooking. Now, that being said,
what's Ayurveda?
Ayurveda is the traditional healing system of India.
Okay.
It is sort of like a healing through food, like food is medicine, use of certain spices. It has a sort of worldview or cosmology that involves different body types or different elements, right? So you can have airy digestion, or you can have fiery digestion, or you can have earthy digestion, and usually you have some combination. And then there are ways to eat seasonally to maximize the balance among those three doshas.
Okay.
So I'm just beginning to scratch the surface and I'm really pretty much self-taught about it, which is fun, but also can be really frustrating. Not all Indian food is in fact what would be considered sattvic, right? Like Ayurvedically balanced. And I think this one definitely is not, like, there's not a lot of meat in traditional Ayurvedic cooking, but I think overall traditional Indian cooking does have a lot of the reliance on spices, on smell and vision, as well as taste and texture. And that's like a fun thing about this recipe, because the saffron you'll taste, but it's also like, it's this wonderful bright color that you sort of just drizzle it over. So yeah. So the way that I do it is, I break it down into the parts, right? So you spend a very small amount of time making rice, but sort of spiced rice, and you put like a, they call it a potli. You could call it a bouquet garni or something, right? You put like spices in it. And you put, essentially like rose water in it, to make it sort of fragrant. And that was another thing that at the Indian grocery store, they're like, no, you want screw pine essence, not rose water. And I was like, and they just would not let me walk out of there with the rose water. Like I just couldn't. So I put screw pine essence in my, which has a sort of piney aroma.
It's like, oh, I already have rose water. That makes sense. I can't remember what I bought it for, but I had some.
I use that in desserts and such, right? Like,
I feel like I made some sort of dessert,
like a Middle Eastern dessert or something.
I had it in there, and I can't remember what, but I did have it. And yeah, this is this part of it, the rice part, was interesting because I haven't made rice this way before.
Yeah.
So listeners, it's basmati rice, but I feel like it's a crazy amount of water.
Yeah.
For how much rice that you're making.
Yeah.
It's like six and a quarter cups of water to a cup and a third of rice.
Yeah.
And you make a little satchel out of, cheesecloth with some cloves and cardamom that you kind of pull, just kind of break up a little bit in a mortar. I can never say this, mortar and pestle.
Have one of those too. It's very satisfying, very good progression.
So you don't, like, it's not ground, it's just kind of coarsely beaten up a little bit. You put it in a little satchel, tie it off with some twine, and you put that in the water once it's boiling with this very small amount of rice, and you stir it every once in a while. I've never made rice this way. I'm interested to see how it turns out. It smelled really good.
It's aromatic. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of different opinions in the Indian recipes I've made about different ways of cooking rice. You also definitely, they're very into you like rinsing and washing your rice before you use it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't usually make it this way either. And it's funny because then it's going to cook a little bit more. So you end up just draining out, you know, the little satchel that's in there and the rose water and everything that you're boiling it in. You then end up just pouring out because you drain it, you know, it doesn't get, so it just like is absorbed into the rice grains. And then I did that this morning and set it aside for a long time. Like it wasn't hot when I put it all together because it took forever. I tried to, we had just gotten over COVID at Passover. Our whole family had COVID. It was terrible.
I just got my second shot on Friday, a couple days
ago. Yeah, we're vaxxed up, and in fact my 12-year-old has gotten one shot, so that's exciting. So, but
14-year-old has as well.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah,
for a different podcast, but I am shocked by the number of local parents who say they would not vaccinate their under 12-year-olds even though they themselves have taken the vaccine. I'm like, you know, what's worse than discomfort is like COVID.
Check out Southern Oregon sometime when you have free time.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Good.
Like an anti-vaxxer, like Mecca.
Yeah. I have, my sister lives in Humboldt County, which is almost Southern Oregon, cause she's in the business, and luckily they're all vaccinated. Anyways, long story short, I was really tired when I was making this at Passover. And I just was like, it was just like the chest keeps going. I can't believe how much more I have to do. And yeah. The meat part to me is kind of like that. Like, I feel like the way it's written, there's like an extra half an hour of meat cooking that it's easy to not notice is happening. So first You like brown the meat and spices in a bunch of ghee, like a ton of ghee.
I was like, that's a lot.
Yeah, and then they want you to put more ghee on top at the end, and ghee. I was like, I'm gonna pass on the extra 2 tablespoons of ghee. Like, I think we've got enough. So you brown it, and then you cook it for quite, 20 minutes, and then you have to, and this I've found in a lot of other recipes, then you do a thing where you want the rest of the water to evaporate. Then you add yogurt to it. So it's not marinated in yogurt, which a lot of other like Indian curries are, but you add the yogurt and which has been mixed with curry paste previously. And then you cook it for another half an hour, and then you take the lid off and you evaporate the water again. And then you add water to it and you cook it for yet another half an hour or 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then you strain it. And that's how you get the gravy. But that meat part always takes me way longer than I realize. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, you brown the, and I was like, oh my God, this is like all day. Yep. Yeah. So I was today. Actually I was out like, with my family. I was like, this I is gotta my... get back.
Yeah. That was me today. I was like, looking at the recipe and I'm cooking it and I'm like, you know what, this dry, and I was getting sort of irritated because my whole family was kind of like bored today, and they all wanted me to like entertain them in some way, and I'm just like, I'm doing this thing, okay? Like, figured out,
doing a thing, people. Sometimes I too do things.
Yeah. And I was the meat process where you have to cook all the liquid out. And this is the thing when I get like irritated with cookbooks sometimes, when they put an actual time in.
Yes.
Don't put the time in. Just say.
Until this happens.
Just say until this happens. Don't say 15 minutes or don't say 20 minutes or 7 minutes or whatever it is. Just say until the liquid is gone. Yeah. Don't, because you're telling me to do this at a medium heat. That's not going to happen. I know this. At medium heat, this liquid is not going to evaporate in 15 minutes. It absolutely will not happen.
It's so. Yeah. It's really, yeah. And I think, well, I went through actually the way that my gateway drug to Indian cooking was actually the Instant Pot, which I got. And every Instant Pot book that you get tells you that it takes you like 25 minutes to make everything. It's like, no. Like, this is not a magic device. No. This is simply a pressure cooker. Like, you are not actually gonna, yeah. So similarly, I feel like it says on the recipe, like, prep time 1.5 hours, cooking time 1 hour. I'm like, no, people, this is an all day experience.
Like, I'm going to tell you this right now. I started at like 12:45 and it finished at 4:30.
Yeah.
So listeners, it's a long process, but I'm really excited about it.
It's this is great for a holiday.
Totally. It's totally great for a holiday. There's sometimes, I mean, if my family wasn't bored and didn't need me to entertain them today, it would have been fine.
Point, because it is a recipe that takes everything out of you. And I am a big believer, listeners, in the idea that the recipe reflects like a sort of like water for chocolate thing. Like, it really, it really tells your process, when the way it comes out, what you're putting in. And so I think, when I bake bread and I'm not really paying attention, the bread doesn't come out as well, so it's really like the biryani I made for Passover when I was just too exhausted to take on anything like that, like, it showed, and it actually needed to, I had to actually go back and put it back in the oven and cook it some more to get it to meld better. But So this time I felt like I was paying a little more attention to the actual gravy and the meat, because that was the first time I was just on my game. And it was New Year's Eve, which feels like everybody's staying up late anyway. You can have dinner at 10 o'clock. Like, who cares? Mm-hmm. That was like my whole thing. And it was like, COVID, so no one was going to come over. It was just us. This was like my project. Mm-hmm. This Passover, I had people waiting for me. They've already had like, hours, or not hours, because we kept it short, but like, we already read all the biz and everything. And I'm like, oh, don't worry, I just got to brown the meat. And then I was like, oh, shit. Yep. So, yeah. So, but if you can settle in for that, you can kind of do it in stages. And so once you get to the end of that, like, yeah, having the water evaporate like twice, then adding more water and adding like different kinds of fats, and then you strain it. And then you add some lemon juice and some mace and cardamom. Mace is a weird thing that I
mace I love. Find. I couldn't
I
find
have not
it.
Used it before.
I couldn't find it, but I used when I was the pastry chef at Le Pigeon. Mace was a thing that I liked to use a lot. Where in the fall, because it's a warm spice, I would use it in. I did like a pumpkin tart. Almost like a pumpkin pie.
Oh,
but
nice.
I would do the crust was with leaf lard, which is like a pork lard, which made it very flaky. But it was a lot of warm spice stuff. And I was turned on to mace from the chef that I worked for at the time. He was like, try this out. And I put it in there and it's like, it's really a nice warm spice to put into a really earthy kind of tasting stuff.
Oh, so I've never ever used it before. And it comes in such a strange, it looks like a flower or something. It's just a funny thing. And then I crunched it up and everything. Mm-hmm. That's interesting. It is. I mean, it makes sense. This is an earthy dish for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, then you're sprinkling that on top and then you're doing all the layering. So the other thing I learned about this is that because usually when I cook Indian food, I do my mise en place, right? Mm-hmm. I always have to have everything.
Gosh.
I have to have it all ready.
So listeners, with this recipe, very important to prep all of your stuff before you start to go into it. I think tossing stuff in. Yeah, if I make this next time, I will prep all of my herbs and spices and everything beforehand, because I was kind of doing it in the order of the recipe. And I realized that I just should have had this stuff all ready to go. It would have saved me an hour probably. So yeah, mise en place.
Mise en place. Yeah. It seems like a big deal for Indian food, because once it gets going, then you're just throwing in, and it's always like a combo of many spices that then you're rummaging around to try to find. But I will say that because I knew the meat was going to take so long, I chopped up my herbs while the meat was going.
Totally. And that you was do have time to do that.
You have time to do that. And you're just like looking over there. And then you just like layer that shit. And it's awesome as you put the meat back in after you've strained the gravy. And then you put a layer of it's mint and cilantro and chilies and ginger, just raw in there. And then some fried onions. So like also PS, you're going to be finding time to randomly fry 4 teaspoons of onions while this is happening. That will be super irritating if you forget that is a thing that you need to do. It will be super irritating to remember that you have to go back and get that. I have noticed in the Indian grocery store that you can buy, much like you can buy those little onions that go on top of like a green bean casserole, you know, you can buy little fried onions in the Indian grocery store. But I hadn't bought them, so I ended up frying onions. And then you just layer it and you seal it with the dough if you're being really proper about it. And then the one thing I forgot the last time I did it is that I didn't bring it to a boil again, and I put it into the oven without having brought it back to the boil. And that actually made a huge difference for how cooked the lamb was, weirdly enough. So I made sure to boil it this time. And then I put it in for about 25 minutes in the oven, and then I just turned the oven off and left it in there. And that's where it is right now.
Okay.
So it will make your house deeply aromatic. And it feels festive. And then, and then at the very end, you pour the saffron, sort of like the saffron and the milk on it. So that'll be a sort of, almost like a stain, but it does have a flavor too.
Mm-hmm. And then you get that sort of smoky, I don't even know how to describe it.
Yeah, saffron just tastes like saffron. I don't know how to.
Yeah.
That saffrony taste, that yellow taste.
Mm-hmm. So let's pause. I'm going to go grab mine.
Oh, yeah. I'm getting mine too. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay, so pause recording and listeners will be right back. So I did have to substitute a couple of things. I couldn't find Mace.
Oh.
So a couple options are like allspice, which mm-hmm. isn't the same, but I mean, you can use that. And the other one is maybe nutmeg.
I thought about nutmeg when I didn't have mace.
But yeah, mace is a hard one to find if you don't work at a restaurant or if you don't have a Indian grocery store around.
I couldn't find it at the Indian grocery. Oh no, I did.
Oh really?
The Indian grocery. I did. That was just, they also wanted to sell me like a biryani spice mix that had like MSG in it and had mace in it already. And they were like, no, don't get more mace. And I was like, I don't want this.
I don't want the MSG.
I do not mean to tell you your business, but that seems incorrect to me.
Yeah. Some people like MSG. I'm okay with it. It doesn't do anything.
Doesn't make me sick or anything. I just thought I didn't know how to adapt the recipe to use a spice mix. Like it didn't ask for a spice.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, it's better just to have everything separated. I don't like mixes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, listeners, we're going to try this. So this is lamb biryani.
Lamb biryani from Hyderabad, which is. It
smells so good.
Yeah, it smells good.
And, you know, of course, no one in my family is going to eat it.
Uh-uh. I'll give it to my father-in-law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, it's really good. I thought it would have more kick to it. Just because
it's not that spicy.
Yeah, I thought it would have a little more spice to it, but it's nice and mellow.
Mm-hmm. Smoky. That's actually... One thing I did this time around is I did 6 chilies instead of 4.
Yeah.
Because I like it a little spicy.
I think I would bump up the chilies just a little bit, listeners, because it's not, unless you don't like spicy. I love spicy. But yeah, it's really good though. This was definitely a challenge for me.
Yeah.
Because it was, I do like to have things that are quick and easy. And that my kids will eat. But then there's also things that I don't care what my kids want to eat.
Yeah.
I want to eat good stuff. And this is definitely something that I really like. Anyway. Okay, listeners, I'm going to take just a pause. And then when we come back, or we're going to talk about Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, starring the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton. Okay, we are going to talk about the 1978 Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, starring Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees. Okay.
With memorable guest appearances.
Lots of memorable guest appearances. So here, I'm going to give the synopsis first, and then we're going to talk about this. Okay? So... This is a musical comedy. It's basically just a musical. There's almost no dialogue in this movie. It's all sung Beatles songs from the Sgt. Pepper's album and Abbey Road, except for, I think, 2 songs get left out.
Sorry.
Let's see. So,
I mean, also that.
Oh, no, here it is. Okay. It has all of the songs from 1967 Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and 1969's Abbey Road, except for Within You, Without You, and Lovely Rita. Those are the only
songs
that aren't in here that are on those 2 albums.
Interesting.
The film had a soundtrack, which was a double album that came out. It's basically a rock opera with The only actual spoken dialogue in it is from George Burns, who plays Mr. Kite, who is the mayor of the town that Sergeant Pepper is from. So here's a little weird synopsis for this movie. So Sergeant Pepper, it starts off in World War One at the very beginning.
For some reason.
And Sergeant Pepper and his Lonely Hearts Club Band, who are from a town called Heartland, have magical instruments. Let's say there's a cornet, a tuba, a saxophone, and a drum. And these things sort of keep the peace in some way. Sergeant Pepper dies, but the town keeps these instruments. And as long as these instruments are, you know, kept within the town, it keeps the peace in the world, I guess. I don't know. This is a really weird, there's a whole lot of suspension of disbelief in whatever the heck is going
on. This is not so much a plot as a pretext.
Totally.
For a variety of scenarios.
Uh-huh. So apparently this was a off-Broadway musical.
Oh, that was when I was like, is this even a movie? It was because I was like, is this like Godspell or something? You know, like, or like Jesus Christ Super, like, this is not, okay. That makes sense, actually.
Okay. So, yeah. So it was an off-Broadway musical that then got turned into a film. And they decided to have the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton depict the Beatles, sort of, or Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band in this movie. And it's basically about these small town boys that get signed to a major label from the big city. And then at the same time, there's like an evil essence, an evil corporation that is trying to get their hands on the instruments to sort of take over the world, I guess. Right?
Something like that.
Yeah. And it's never really clear. It's very, very weird.
It is. It is extremely, I was going to say psychedelic, but that's the wrong word.
Yeah. It's not psychedelic. Like the Who's Tommy is psychedelic. It's
right.
Like a different kind of psychedelic. So you start out with this like small town, sort of like there's a gazebo in the center of town, and like the new Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which consists of Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees, which his name is Billy Shears. And
right, because of that one song. There was a lot of mining of lyrics for plot devices, but the problem is that the lyrics were written by people who were not thinking linearly.
Totally.
So it's like, yep, there is the mention of someone named Billy Shears, but he wasn't really a person.
Uh-huh. So Billy Shears is Peter Frampton.
That's Peter Frampton.
And then the other three are the Bee Gees, and I don't remember what their names are because it's
it's not. But it's the Hendersons, because the Hendersons will all be there. Like I was noticing how they were trying to lyrically pin it to the, I was like, okay, there's the Hendersons.
Uh-huh. So they're the Hendersons.
And they're brothers.
And then Billy Shears.
So they got that sweet blood harmony going on.
They do.
That was the best part.
Because they're the Bee Gees.
They're the Bee Gees.
And then you have Billy Shears' girlfriend, Strawberry Fields. Wink, wink.
Yeah. That's a reference. I don't know if you caught that, but that's a reference.
Yeah. Margaret, I want to just point out that this movie was my first sort of, was the first time, but I saw it very young, and this is my first like involvement with the Beatles.
Oh.
I thought these were the Beatles.
Ooh.
Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees were the Beatles.
Ooh.
That's how old I am. And also because the Beatles weren't like really much of a thing in my household.
No!
This movie, and I thought these guys were the Beatles.
I mean...
And I never really told anybody this until now.
I love that. I love that.
And
what a strange and wonderful lineage.
It's really weird. I've, like, for years, the reason I picked this movie is because for years, my sister and I had seen this movie a lot. And I don't remember how. I think it was on cable or something, or like, we didn't really have cable when I was a kid. I saw it multiple times.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was like, this couldn't have been the movie of the week, or, you know, on UPN, you know, or whatever. I don't know.
But
it was pre-VCR for sure.
Like, I mean, I'd ask people if they'd ever seen this movie before. I was convinced my sister and I were the only people that knew this existed.
Yeah.
You know, it, and based on how well it did in the movie theaters, maybe that's true. but listeners, this movie is crazy because it not only is it Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees as the Beatles, but you have a star-studded cast, including Alice Cooper, Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Oh, yeah.
Kurt Smith. God, who else is in it? It's like a crazy...
Well, the group, the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds group is somebody. I didn't know who they were, but they were billed as a group.
Yeah, I don't remember them.
You've got, at the end, you know how the back of the record album of Sgt. Pepper's has all those famous people cut out? So they have real famous people. Mm-hmm. Like, they have Carol Channing. And like
Carol Channing? I was like, what's going on?
Like, wait, what? And it took me a minute to put together that that's what was going on. So I did kind of look back. It I don't know. A number of sort of 70s rock stars that I'm not all that up on my 70s music. So, but definitely Meatloaf.
Oh, was Meatloaf in there? I didn't.
Yeah.
Okay.
Meatloaf was in there looking very pained, actually. I was like, oh, Meatloaf, it's hard to be you. But oh, and are you a Twin Peaks fan?
Sometimes, yeah.
The guy who plays the giant towards the end of Twin Peaks second season, yeah.
He is
in it.
The brute.
He's the brute. And like, you just would never not recognize that face. And I think besides, you know, George Burns, there's a number of character actors. Like, it almost should have been, you know, like a Richard Lester film or something like that. You know, like there was something about it that was very madcap in a way that, I don't know. My sister and I watched the movie Help a bunch of times when I was a kid. And that movie was always like hilarious and awesome to us in a way that it could never be to a grown-up person, you know, because I think we thought this was how the Beatles actually like lived and what their life was like back in the day or whatever. But that one similarly has like Leo Kearns, and it has like all these like, you know, character actors making the Beatles look good while the Beatles just like, you know, run around and do stuff. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I feel like Bernadette Peters is in that group in the back. Like, it also reminded me a little bit. George Martin. The jerk. What is his name?
Oh, Steve Martin.
Steve Martin is in it.
Martin is the most is definitely the most memorable part of that movie. He plays Dr. Maxwell. You know, bang bang Maxwell, silver hammer. That
right.
So, which is like also one of the weirdest and kind of one of the most interesting. I'm going to break down that scene for a second.
Okay. Break it down. Break it down.
So what happens is this unforeseen bad thing is trying to get all the Sgt. Pepper's instruments, right? And they're called FVB. But we don't know what that is for a while. FVB, or they like a single entity, but we find out later that it's like more than a single entity. So FVB it wants all of the instruments, and there's and this bad guy, Mr. Mustard, right, is supposed to take these instruments to different places. He's supposed to keep the drum for himself, but he's supposed to take the cornet to Dr. Maxwell. He is supposed to take the tuba to
the Alice Cooper.
Father Son, who is played by Alice Cooper. And then he is supposed to take the saxophone to him, FVB. We don't know what that means. So let's see. Peter Frampton, let's just call them the fake Beatles. Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees go to this Dr. Maxwell's place to try to recover the stolen cornet. And it's basically, there's a lot of like social commentary in this movie that gets kind of buried by how goofy and weird it is.
Yeah, I have. Yeah.
This one is about, Dr. Maxwell, played by Steve Martin, is basically a bizarro, like plastic surgeon, but also can do brain transplants and stuff like that. And seems to work for this higher bad guy, right? So they come in. He sings the song. This is the thing about this movie. Everything is sung. There's no dialogue. It's all dancing and singing. It's very, very interesting and weird. But they sing Bang Bang Maxwell Silverhammer came down upon her head, all of that stuff. At the same time, while this is happening, so it's basically like some people on a conveyor belt.
Yeah. And
bings them with this little hammer, which then turns them into people that look like they're in like Cub Scout or like Nazi youth uniforms, sort of.
Yes. There's a lot of like, yeah.
And this is the year or 2 years after the first Star Wars came out.
Yes.
And there's
a fight scene.
There's a fight with like big, like pole things, and it's clearly supposed to be sort of like lightsabery.
Mm-hmm. I remember that part. Peter Frampton and the dentist guy, whatever the dentist. It reminds me of his part in Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, totally.
Right? Yeah. It's a reference to that. And I don't know which came first, but I'm gonna assume.
This is before
probably Little. Oh, it is.
It is. Yeah, Little Shop of Horrors was in the 80s. This is like 70s. So yeah, he definitely brought some of that over.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I assumed it was the opposite, that it was like this intertextual, like, this is what Steve Martin is known for these days.
Mm-mm. Yeah, I loved Little Shop of Horrors, but I remember that more vividly because I was older.
You were older.
Yeah. I love musicals. Anyway, even really weird ones like this. So I'm not like a super Beatles fan. I like the Beatles, but I'm not like one of those, like the Beatles were the best thing ever. There are definitely some things that I was just like, whoa, this is weird. Particularly like some of the arrangements of the songs.
Yep.
And how they were how they were executed in this movie.
Yep. Yep.
I would like to know your input on some of these, but the one that made me like the most like, what is going on, was is when Strawberry Fields sings she and Peter Frampton he's about to leave, and she sings
Here Comes the Sun.
Is that what it is? Good Day Sun?
I think it's Here Comes the Sun.
I'm sorry. Yes, Here Comes the Sun. She's singing comes the son to him as they wake up, like in a barn or something in the morning, like they've hung out.
A sexy barn. They haven't just hung out. Also, his shirt is unbuttoned.
Like childhood crush on her. And I don't know who that woman is, but like, I thought she was really like, I watching it, I was like, oh yeah, I really was like, I remember her. that song, this is just a total like musician sort of thing in my head. The bass player on that song could not like lay back. There's like so much bass going on in that song, and it's like, it's for Here Comes the Sun. It's like the craziest. I'm just like, dude, you are overdoing it.
That's amazing.
And I probably didn't notice it when I was younger, but like now as an like 40 something, I'm just like, I was like, wow, like who okayed that? Oh, you know,
George Martin. That's who. Yeah, that's who.
Yeah.
So just think about that for a second. That was what kept blowing my mind, is I was like, clearly George Martin, like all of the Beatles were like still alive and clearly had to sign off on this. Totally. Right. And like, and then George Martin was like, yes, please let me come in and just make these into insane arrangements. And some of them were awesome. Like the vocord, Fembots sang, what did they sing? She's Leaving Home.
Yes, yes.
The Fembots, like, I, first of all, the only thing I know about Peter Frampton is like vocorder. So I was like, if there's no vocorder in this film, I will be cheated. So I was like, oh, thank you for, you know, giving the Fembots a chance to include that important element. But that was an insane arrangement. Mm-hmm. I also thought the arrangement of I Want You, She's So Heavy was kind of amazing.
My favorite part of that movie, She's So Heavy, is so good.
It's so good because it's the blood harmony. You know, like, I'm just like, yes, like the Bee Gees, like, and if you listen to the early Bee Gees records, like they were very Beatlesque in their early days, right? So like they can do that kind of harmony. So I just imagine George Martin like getting on in years a little bit and being like, okay. Like, you know, so some of them work better than others. I thought the Earth, Wind and Fire, their arrangement was pretty cool. Yeah. Like I was like, yeah, but they're not Broadway songs. They're not expositional songs. And so trying to make like Here Comes the Sun into a song about people waking up together and then saying goodbye, like doesn't make any sense at all. Even.
I read a little bit about the guy who arranged it, and I can't think of his name right off.
Oh, it's not George Martin. I just assumed that. He was the guy who brought orchestration to the Beatles. I actually know a lot about the Beatles.
Yeah. I mean, George Martin.
The Beatles were a big part of my childhood.
George Martin helped with the, like the musical arrangement for the movie and stuff, but the
guy that wrote like the musical.
Yeah. The off-Broadway thing. So whoever got the rights to use the music for the off-Broadway thing, I read something about how he just laid all the songs out and then tried to write a song, write a story around the songs. And that's totally obvious in this movie.
Yes.
Where like, imagine like, here's 25 songs, make a story.
Yeah.
That seems crazy to me.
That, yeah. And, no, that was a terrible idea. And again, 100% here for the Bee Gees. Like I gotta say that like Barry Gibb is not unhot at that stage in his life, and his, you know, pants situation was always very intense.
Okay, so Robin is the one that I'm thinking of.
Robin is the one who has kind of tragic hair.
Yes.
Well, no, the other two have tragic, because the other one is also like balding a little bit, but I feel like balding in the late 70s was kind of okay. I don't know, in a way that maybe it wasn't later on. But there's a lot. But I do think I was like, okay, so this is like post Saturday Night Fever Bee Gees. Like, this was the project they decided to take on. This is post Peter Frampton Comes Alive, Peter Frampton. This is the project he chooses to take on. This is like Aerosmith, like Toys in the Attic Aerosmith or something. Like, I don't even know. And like, I was amazed by, like, I think that Steven Tyler, just that whole sequence. So he's like, okay, listeners. So like, you, there's some sort of, yeah, like sort of Hitler Youth kind of like, you know, choreographed dancing on a set that is sort of tilted, and they've got Strawberry Fields tied up to a giant neon sign with a dollar sign on it. And like the Bee Gees and Peter Frampton are trying to save her. And some people are tied up for some reason. I can't remember, but then you've got this like satanic band, which is Aerosmith, and they're wearing, you know, some very, their outfits, they've got like, you know, high heeled boots and so forth. But, you know, Steven Tyler's kind of doing his shtick, which as a child of the 80s, I'm deeply familiar with, right? But he can't seem to move on the stage at all. So he's supposed to like writhe over to Strawberry Fields and like minister, but he ends up just sort of like vaguely tiptoeing over there and then awkwardly wrapping his like microphone scarves around her. And I was like, oh, Steven Tyler, you had one job to be like menacingly sexy, and that didn't happen. And then she like just full on, they both just like die.
Yep.
In that moment, which is also super intense. Yeah, Steven Tyler totally dies, and then Strawberry Fields dies, and Peter Frampton has to go and find this out while wearing a satin tracksuit with rainbows on it.
Yes.
So the 70s were a weird time. But the other thing that happened around all of this, like sort of queer subversive, do your own thing, money is bad, and if you're into money, you're like, you know, a Stalinist kind of stuff. Then in the meantime, there's this weird, like, because once the Magical Instruments are gone from Heartland, then like all these like brothels move into town, and there's like all this pinball and gambling, and like everything's like gone to shit. And like, and it's very like, I'm like, wait, isn't this supposed to be the time when everybody's fucking? Like, why are they so upset about? So it was very like, I was like, was Ronald Reagan president yet? Like, I don't even know. Like, it has this weirdly conservative message. And I don't know if the Bee Gees were like, yeah, we need to get on board with this whole, like, you know, gambling and urban decay are bad kind of message or what, but there's a lot of that too, which is really odd.
You know, the part when there's a part when they're supposed to sign their contracts with the big record label.
Yes.
And it's like they have wine glasses that are the size of, like, I don't even know, like fish aquariums.
Yeah.
They're huge.
And it's whimsical. It's whimsical.
And my teen daughter walked in, and she was watching this, and she was like, did someone put drugs in that girl's drink? And I was like, actually, they just put it in that guy's drink.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because they want him to sign a contract.
No, because the guys were all victims of like evil female like temptations and wiles.
Right. And they were all from like a small town, and like they were now in the big city, and like being very like, they didn't know how the real world worked.
They were naive.
They were naive, and they came in and they like signed their lives away to the big evil record company.
Which PS is what I thought the story was going to be initially. I was like, oh, this is going to be a story about, and then there was all then there were all these other things.
Yes. There's so much crazy stuff in this movie.
There's an amazing stretch limousine though. I was also a big fan of that.
The stretch limousine that has six wheels for some reason, six doors also. And when it first pulls out, this is another Star Wars reference because, you know, I'm a Star Wars nerd.
I know you're a Star Wars guy.
When it pulls away, the sound effect that they use is actually a land speeder from Star Wars. And
really?
When it pulled away, I was like, I wonder how they got the rights to use that. But, you know, it was early days, so it was probably
okay. Probably it was cheap. Yeah.
I want to read a quote from Robin Gibb on what this movie, something he said about this movie. Okay. Robin Gibb, who's the bass player for the Bee Gees and has the tragic hair, according to Margaret. Quote, There is no such thing as the Beatles now. They don't exist as a band and never performed Sgt. Pepper live in any case. Oh. When ours comes out, it will be, in effect, as if theirs never existed.
Ooh. Ooh. Those are bold words, Robin Gibb. How much cocaine were they doing? I feel like that's some grandiose ideation there.
I know.
Mr. Gibb. Interesting. Because, like, that's the other thing is, like, I think I grew up, like, so I grew up listening to the Beatles a lot. And so I knew all these songs in their original form really, really well. And I grew up watching the Beatles movies too, which I think we must have had on VHS cassette. So, like, later when I was older. But when I was very, very young, I just had the records and I listened to the records all the time. And I couldn't, like, to me, the Beatles were people who were also dead, right? Like, they weren't all dead, but, like, John Lennon died when I was five. Like, as far as I was concerned, it was like, so in this moment, they're actually all alive. And he's saying that, like, I feel like that's so great. Like, it's like, John Lennon is going to kick your ass, bro. Like,
yeah. What? Hey, we gave you the rights to use this music for this ridiculous,
I guess,
fucking weird movie.
Right. They don't do that. Although I will say this is a period when John Lennon was raising Sean Lennon and, like, was watching the wheels go around. He was, like, not involved in the world all that much from what I understand. So, but yeah, I'm not like the Beatles are super great either, but I was definitely, they were the music that I just had a bunch of, I think my parents must have got us. We had a record player and my sister and me, and we would just listen to we had the red album and the blue album, which were like compilations of Beatles songs. So the red one was the early one songs, and then the blue one, and they were both double records. Mm-hmm. And we would sort of listen through the whole Beatles career. Was a thing that we did a lot. So yeah, so it was interesting in that regard, just to, like, I thought certain elements of the musical arrangements were way better. I was like, hot damn, like, you know, the harmonies on She's So Heavy were awesome.
Dude, I could listen to, I keep saying dude, I don't know why I'm saying that.
I've said bro a bunch, so.
Bro.
Bruh. My kids say bruh all the time now. I don't know if that's it. I don't know what that is.
Yeah, She's So Heavy is probably the greatest part of this movie.
Yeah, I was getting excited.
It's actually I think it's a better version.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's actually really cool.
I agree.
Your family was like a Beatles family. My wife's family also was. I mean, my wife is sort of like commandeered. We have like an original pressing of the White Album and the original pressing.
Oh, that's cool.
Sergeant Pepper and also Rubber Soul that she stole from her family. But I was a Beach Boys household.
But, like, I mean, that's a similar musical mentality. Like, I feel like in some ways it was like a post Pet Sounds rendition of Sgt. Pepper, although I think they're pretty concomitant, right? Isn't Pet Sounds is also 67?
Yeah. So the Beatles were sort of, from what I remember, Pet Sounds was like what they wanted, they were wishing they had done. Like, they're,
oh, okay,
Pet Sounds, and we're like, this is crazy. Like, we didn't do what
we missed the boat.
Yeah, a little bit, but they didn't.
I think Sgt. Pepper is kind of a dumb album, frankly.
Really?
I do. I never even liked it as a kid. I like the I like the Abbey Road songs better, and I like the White Album songs a lot better.
If they have more staying power.
But the, like, I was like, they are at some point in this film, they are going to have to do a day in the life, and it is maybe going to kill me, is what I thought. And low, it was, I was like, oh wow, we're just, yeah. But I was like, they're going to have to sing stuff like, now they know how many holes it takes to fill the Alfred Hall. And that's not going to make any sense. Yeah. I don't care what kind of context you give it.
It won't make any sense.
But they really worked hard on it. Like, there was like a newspaper so he could say, like, I read the news.
Yep.
And that was, you know, and that was my Bayberry. So I was feeling it. He was looking hot in his funeral attire. So, you know, but, yeah, but I do think at times the vocal harmonies and just the pure kind of like musicianship that the Bee Gees brought to it was way better than anything the Beatles ever did. Cause the Beatles are not really that, they're very simple. Like, they're not really actually that skilled. They're self-taught, you know?
But that, like, the fact that they kept it simple, like, does allow other people
to come in and do stuff with, crazy for sure.
Stuff with what they did, because there's like a good, like, what do you call it? Foundation.
Good bones.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out. Yeah. This is why I wish I had, well, as a nerd, mm-hmm. mostly I feel like I'm just lacking the proper information to understand this text. So I'm like, what was happening in 1978 that I don't understand? Or like, what was the, you know, like, cause like it, on the one hand, it really did remind me, like, my summer camp did a production of Godspell, right? Like, and that's like, you know, you're wearing the, you know, like the overalls and the rainbow suspenders, and you're like in a, you know, kind of carnival-esque atmosphere. And like, you saw a lot of that. Well, and they even had the benefit from Mr. Kite thing, which was like, so yeah. So I'm just like, what is it that I misunderstood? Like, and like remembering the moment that George Burns had, right? That there were those Oh God movies, which I also some reason watched a ton of those. I should go back and watch, like,
God, you devil.
Sings the first Beatles. Yes, the first Beatles song that is even sung in that entire thing, I think, is sung by George Burns. I was like, holy like, this is happening. I can't remember which one he sings, but he sort of like, he does like a Richard Burton and Camelot style talking to it.
I actually have it right here. Let me see. He sings. Yeah. He sings Fixing a Hole. And those two little cute girls sing with
two little girls with them. With
overalls. It's really adorable.
That to me was very Godspell. I was like, all right, you know, are we going to, you know, are you going to lay some Christianity on us too? But I just couldn't. I was like, how is it possible? It seemed so un-rock and roll. You know, in a way that I felt like, I don't know much about Peter Frampton, but I feel like the Bee Gees were kind of like fine with that. And did you watch that recent documentary about the making of Saturday Night Fever and stuff?
No, but I feel like now
there's a Bee Gee documentary. Oh, you should watch. It's fascinating. Listeners. It's fascinating. And it's completely like, let's just erase like everything that people of color were doing in the disco world and pretend that the Bee Gees invented disco, which I, you know, I'm no musicologist, but I think is false, but, but it is just, they were interesting people in the sense that they had no aspirations other than to be a pop sensation, right? Like, they weren't trying to be like authentic or gritty or any, they were just like, how can we figure out, like, and they were super talented and they were multi-instrumentalists and they were this and they were that. They were like, how can we like hit big? So it just seems to me kind of amazing that it really didn't take, like, I think the Beatles break up in like 1969 or 1970. Like, it didn't even take a decade for that, whatever it is that the Beatles pretended to be. And I'm not going to sit here and say that they were actually the most innovative or the most amazing or whatever. Had already just become so denatured at that point that you could have a like 90-year-old comedian talk singing one of their songs with two little girls. Like, and like, even the Beatles, have you watched the Beatles movies? Like, none of them tried to tell a story with the songs really at all. The songs are just spooky.
It was just
there. I was like, come on, guys, you don't have to work so hard. It's fine. I will totally watch you do whatever. Like, I actually really liked the Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds. I liked that also.
When they're up on the billboards.
Yeah.
And
Strawberry Fields is singing some of it.
Imagining.
She's watching.
Yeah, it's yes. Like it doesn't actually happen, but yes.
Yes, you know, it's a dream sequence.
The movie, having it had come out when I was very young, but I'm sure I didn't see it when I was four.
No, sorry.
But I did see it later. I feel like the same, some of the same sort of plot points in this movie is the reason why I love the movie Purple Rain.
Say more.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's a similar film structure.
Yeah.
The band that you're rooting for.
Yeah.
There's the girl band that kind of like messes with them a little.
Maybe kind of a little bit of a temptress. Yeah.
And then there's the bad band, which is like Morris Day and the Time, but in this one, it's Aerosmith. So,
yes.
So, you know, it's, I don't know.
I don't know. Yeah. Except for that then there was all this other stuff with the instruments and Steve Martin and it was a lot to take in. It was a lot to take in, but I feel like I'm a better person for it. And
how many times
I watched it once, bro. And I fast forward. Like, I was like, okay, this guy's going to be singing when I'm 64. Like, I will now fast forward because I can't.
That is the
have that experience. Okay.
If Heavy is the best arrangement in that movie, When I'm 64 is the worst thing in that movie. It's
just so, and it's so contrived. It's like, it's a lot of music though. It really is a pure musical. I don't know that much. Actually, Peter Schaefer knows more about the musical than I do as a form.
Yeah, so.
But yeah, I don't know. I got to go back. I got to read some like political economy. I got to find out what the hell was going on in 1978 besides Star Wars. Cause I couldn't really wrap my mind. Like I was three. Yeah. So like, I don't remember that moment.
I wonder what other movies came out in 1978.
Right. And like, what was happening? Like what, who, like, yeah, Peter Frampton was not even that, like he was very derpy throughout it. I was like, I know we're supposed to like identify with him and he's like Paul McCartney and blah.
Have you ever seen a man that thin before?
Oh, he's very, that's why I was also wondering just how much cocaine was being consumed at any given moment because everyone was very thin.
When he's in his white overalls and he's like running up, I was like,
yes,
the skeleton.
Yes. He's got the figure of like a 13-year-old girl. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, way to go, Peter Frampton, I guess.
Listeners, this movie is an absolute freak show. And I think you should watch it because of that.
You should watch it because of that and think about what rock music thought was happening to it at that moment and what, like, I don't know, why are the bad women all black too? Like what's going on with that? Like sexuality, like temptation.
They were bad or sexy. So
yeah, exactly. Like
thinking like sexy is bad or
sexy is definitely bad. And you know, but I thought, you know, cause my stereotype, I feel like as a somewhat late period Gen X person, I was supposed to think more about the 70s than I actually did. Cause it's like, no, I don't actually remember that. Right.
Right.
But like, even if I was born in the 70s, I wasn't fully conscious for them, but I felt like my idea of the 70s was that everyone was very sex positive in that moment. So I was like, I was very surprised by the, like the sort of wholesomeness. Like I could get the wholesomeness in like you say, a sort of standard band story, right? That the wholesomeness is about being authentic in your roots and blah. But like, it seemed to be specifically about real estate in weird ways and like urban blight, right? I was like, wait, what's that? This is what I'm saying. I need more information.
Oh God. I mean, there's like 4 hours to unpack with this movie. Listeners, just watch this movie and
watch it and keep a,
it's not a long one too. It's like hour and 52 minutes and it's all, you can sing along. It's weird.
It's very, and there's a lot of, despite the terrible dancing that is done by most of the principals, there's a lot of excellent backup dancing that happens.
This is true. And I would like to say that, like, you know, even though they were sort of Hitler youthy sort of Cub Scouts, I love the Maxwell Silverhammer dance.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And the Fembots.
Fembots are awesome. Would you suggest watching this movie?
Would I suggest watching this movie? Yes, I would. For the She's So Heavy for the high-waisted and yet very, very tight fitting pants.
Mm-hmm.
And just for like, I want to get somebody to watch it who is like a little bit older than me, who might have been like, oh yeah, of course, that was that thing. I want somebody to tell me what the hell.
I want somebody to watch it with me, or to watch it and then explain to me who Stargard is, because I've never heard of that band.
Me either.
it's like all the other bands I was familiar with in somewhat, Aerosmith.
Yep.
Alice yep. Cooper, Billy Preston, even Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Definitely.
Stargard. Don't know who that is.
What? Don't even know. Yeah. And there is some sort of like an Afrofuturist, like that was the Earth, Wind, and Fire part where they actually come down in some sort of a rocket or like a, that was, I was like, okay, Sun Ra, like, let's go.
When they come down in the pods.
Yeah, the pods. Almost, that's what I'm talking about.
It's almost, Spinal Tap-ish. I feel like Spinal Tap sort of like stole that from Earth, Wind, and Fire.
Definitely. The Spinal Tap people. What is that guy's name? He watched this film like a lot.
Christopher Guest.
Christopher Guest definitely saw this film in the theaters. And for that, I think we should thank him because he's given us a lot of great stuff.
Yep. Okay, Margaret.
All right.
Nice talking to you about this.
It was great to talk to you.
Watching this ridiculous movie that I suggested that is like, you know, a touchstone of my childhood.
I am so glad to know that these are the things that formed you.
Mm-hmm. As far as I know, Peter Frampton and the Bee Gees are the Beatles.
I love that. I love that lineage. Knowing that you are a person who has made music, that thrills me even more.
And listeners, make sure you try this recipe out too. It is.
Do it.
It can be stressful, but it's so worth it. It's really just delicious.
Buckle in. Just set yourself. Just clear your schedule and then realize that you can share a late dinner with other lamb-loving friends and possibly have leftovers. It's, you know, it's not even bad. Room temperature.
Indeed. Awesome.
Anyway.
And there we have it. Remember to check out Dinner with Nate on Instagram for pictures and recipes. Leave me a review on Apple Pods if you like the show. More ratings and more reviews will make it easier for new listeners to find the pod. I trust the 30 of you listening to spread the word. Try this food out. And check out this movie. I'm Nate Flansburgh, and this was Dinner with Nate. As always, thanks for listening.